Welcome to this special follow-up program to a satellite CME symposium held in Chicago in June during the annual ASCO meeting. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. For this symposium, we took our meet the professors type approach and focused on a number of major issues in the management of lymphomas, CLL, and multiple myeloma. I met with two of the faculty members who participated in the symposium, Drs. Nupur Rajay and Sonali Smith, and reviewed the discussions and data points discussed in the meeting, as well as a survey given to the audience. Along the way, we also chatted about what happened at ASCO in these various tumor types and the perspective of the faculty on these new data sets. To begin, I met with Dr. Smith to talk about lymphomas and CLL, and she began by providing a broad overview of current management of diffuse large B-cell lymphoma.
Almost 20 years ago, we learned that there's at least two gene expression profiles in diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, so two different subtypes hiding in the same histology. And, you know, that was a very exciting and important discovery, and the thought was it would translate to differences in treatment. So there have now been a number of ways to try to improve upon R-CHOP, both for general DLBCL, but then also for these subsets. And what's happened most recently is that there have been a number of trials that focus specifically on what was considered the poor prognosis group, the non-germinal center diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. So we've had the Pyramid trial, which was R-CHOP with or without bortezomib. We've had the Phoenix trial, which is R-CHOP with or without ibrutinib. And literally as we speak, the Robust trial is being presented, which is R-CHOP with or without lenalidomide. And all of these trials, I think, you know, the big picture finding is that there hasn't been a huge difference in outcome. In other words, R-CHOP remains the standard of care. And I think there's a lot of reasons for this. One is that the studies use different ways to determine who has non-germinal center diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, and I think that may be important. The other piece that's increasingly important is that in general, diffuse large B-cell lymphoma patients are sick patients. And yet the ones that go on to the trials, there is this inadvertent selection bias. So that if you are stable enough to wait for the registration, to wait until you've gone through eligibility, and then to start, you've already selected the best of the worst disease, if you will. And so I think it's going to be harder to show a difference in that population. One thing I saw this morning, maybe just on Twitter, was that at least for the Robust trial, the median time from diagnosis to actually starting therapy was a month. And so you think about this in your clinical practice, and you know most diffuse large B-cell lymphoma patients can't wait a month. So automatically that tells you a little bit about the people who are on the trial.
And when you talked about the Robust trial, again, reflecting the incredible rapidity of things changing, because again, 2 weeks ago we were talking about this, all we had was a press release. And as you mentioned, I guess what, at the EHA meeting, they're presenting the data now?
That's correct. There's the Lugano meetings and the EHA meetings, both of which are essentially this week and next.
Right. And anything more to say about the strategy of adding novel therapy in? Your kind of global thought that it doesn't look that exciting is important to note, but is it kind of a dead issue? I know there's been issues about the selection of patients or maybe the way the trials are actually executed in terms of, I guess with the ibrutinib, there was the issue of older versus younger patients. Is there anything there or is it time to move on?
Yeah, no, you're raising some really, really important points. I mean, for one thing, you mentioned the issue of age, and I think, you know, what we know about diffuse large B-cell lymphoma is that it's incredibly heterogeneous. And so the Phoenix trial, for example, included both younger and older patients. And one of the subset analyses showed that in older patients, the addition of ibrutinib not only didn't help, but may have been detrimental, whereas in the younger patient, the addition of ibrutinib to R-CHOP seemed very promising. So it may be that when we design these trials, we either have to stratify or pre-plan for some of these subsets. But your question about adding in new agents for this disease. You know, one of the more provocative, if you will, presentations at ASCO was by MD Anderson, the SMART trial. Jason Weston presented this lead-in of two cycles of ibrutinib, lenalidomide, and rituximab in treatment-naive diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. And when you think about it, I mean, this is a non-chemotherapy biologic agent regimen for 2 cycles before R-CHOP is ever given. And, you know, I think it takes quite a bit of conviction to be able to do it, but the trial really was interesting with a very high overall response rate, 86% in the first 2 cycles, just with those agents alone before the R-CHOP was added in. So it's a small study. It's a single, you know, arm, single institution study, 60 patients. But, you know, when we think about adding new agents into frontline diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, maybe that is the strategy to take. And one other piece about that trial is that it was limited to the non-germinal center diffuse large B-cell lymphoma population. So he certainly enriched for the people most likely to respond to lenalidomide and ibrutinib.
That's such a cool concept, though. It almost reminds me of neoadjuvant treatment. You know, sometimes, like I saw, like neoadjuvant checkpoint inhibitors before you go to lung surgery. So, you know, it does also get into the issue, though, what you were talking about, having to delay. But let me get this straight. Rituximab, ibrutinib, and lenalidomide.
Mm-hmm.
So sort of R-squared ibrutinib?
Right. And the interesting thing about that triplet is that it's been tested in other settings. As part of Alliance, there is a trial that looked at frontline follicular lymphoma that concluded it was too toxic a regimen because there was so much grade 3 rash. And there's a similar study in mantle cell lymphoma where there was quite a bit of toxicity. So it's interesting that at least in this setting, that degree of rash wasn't seen, and it seemed to be a tolerable regimen. And I think we'll learn more about it. But when it comes to diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, I think improving upon R-CHOP has had a setback, if you will, with all of these large, you know, scale phase 3 trials, you know, not really changing the needle or moving the needle. But there may be other ways to think about it, especially as we learn more about the biology.
Wow, what a concept. What about R-squared in diffuse large B-cell? Has that ever been used, like, up front?
Yeah, not up front just by itself, but R-squared added to CHOP, which is the robust study,
sure,
as well as an ECOG trial. But no, that has not been done.
Wow.
Which makes this other study even more, you know, we know that R-squared in the relapsed and refractory setting for diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, there are phase 2 data, but I would say that in practice, I certainly use R-squared for patients with relapsed and refractory diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, especially if they have the non-germinal center phenotype.
Right. And it's interesting because most investigators do that, but a lot of docs in practice don't, which I've never been able to sort of figure out because, you know, clearly it does help people. So, wow, I'm still trying to process that, but really interesting.
Yeah.
I guess one other point before we start moving on to relapse disease and actually coming back to where we might be not too distant future up front in terms of maybe polatuzumab up front.
Mm-hmm.
But this point you brought up about waiting a month to go on a clinical trial, I'm not sure I've, you know, kind of thought about that or heard about that before. That's a really interesting concept. Do you feel that in a way it's providing a disadvantage to the patient? Or it's actually a disadvantage to go in the trial then? And are there people that you don't put in trials because you don't want to wait?
Yeah, it's exactly that. I don't think it's a disadvantage for the people who actually make it to the trial because they biologically have disease that can wait, you know, which happens. But there's actual data for this from the Mayo Clinic, and Matt Maurer has published this, that, you know, at least looking back, the survival of patients who needed to start therapy within 14 days versus more than 14 days was worse. So these had higher risk disease. So if you have bad disease and you need to start right away, you can't wait. That's really the sickest population. Whereas if you can wait more than 14 days, the outcomes are ironically better, you know, with the theory being that their disease had a perhaps a slightly slower pace and they just weren't quite as high risk, even if they have the same IPI or the same pathology result.
So before we move on to polatuzumab, in general, when you think about diffuse large B-cell, what are you estimating to be the risk of relapse in germinal and non-germinal disease nowadays with R-CHOP?
I mean, all comers for DLBCL, I usually think about a third of patients at risk for relapse. And, you know, germinal center and non-germinal center is only part of what I look at when I think about the risk of relapse. I do think the IPI still has a lot to do with prognosis. And we know that this dichotomy of germinal center and non-germinal center is not complete. So in the last year and a half, for example, you know, we've had publications from Margaret Shipp, from Lou Stout, and from Sandeep Dave, all showing large-scale genomic analyses that I think are going to challenge the germinal center and non-germinal center paradigm. So I think it's part of how I think about relapse, but not really the majority of what I predict. And we also have things like double hit and double expression of MYC and BCL2, which are not part of the cell of origin model.
I was just more thinking of it from a macro point of view, almost like a public health point of view. When you think about the frequency diffuse large B-cell, and even though we think about it as a curable disease, you're saying a third of people globally relapse. So relapse, diffuse large B-cell, and we found that when we surveyed general medical oncologists. There are plenty of those people out there in practice. Well, as of, I guess, a couple days ago, there's another option for those people, which is polatuzumab. So first of all, let's talk a little bit about what exactly polatuzumab is.
Yep. So polatuzumab vedotin is another antibody drug conjugate. It has the same payload as brentuximab vedotin, which is this MMAE or monomethyl auristatin E. And its target is CD79. And so it attaches to CD79. It gets internalized, releases the MMAE, and by itself has, you know, relatively favorable toxicity profile. There's some neuropathy, there's some cytopenias, but really no significant unique toxicities. And the study that you've been alluding to is a study, it's a randomized phase 2 trial of BR with or without polatuzumab that led to the approval of polatuzumab plus BR in relapse and refractory DLBCL. And the interesting thing about those curves is, and I find this in so many parallel diseases, including CLL, when you see how far the curves separate, makes you wonder what the BR is really adding. You know, right after the BR is done at 6 months, the relapses in the BR arm start right away. And in polatuzumab, there is a significant improvement in progression-free survival. So knowing that in general, for relapse and refractory DLBCL, median survival is quite poor, usually on the order of 6 months or so, you know, this is quite impressive.
I don't know that bendamustine is used that much in diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, is it?
No, I mean, I think that out of desperation, I've certainly used it in the relapsed and refractory setting if I have nothing else that's available. And being in primary medical oncology, I mean, what are the tools available to a person in practice if diffuse large B-cell lymphoma relapses? I mean, go back to chemotherapy alone, which isn't well tolerated and doesn't really work very well. You've got R-squared, and now you've got Pola plus BR. I think if you have access to transplant and access to CAR T, you know, that's where today I would send my patients, but not everybody's going to have that available, and not all patients are going to want that or be eligible for the more aggressive options.
And, yeah, of course, I want to kind of move in the direction of trying to figure out where this all kind of fits in, particularly as it relates to CAR T. But just to continue now with the polatuzumab, so what do we know about it as a single agent, diffuse large B-cell?
As a single agent, it's been tested in a phase 2 setting, and it's got modest activity and really well tolerated. So I don't remember the exact numbers offhand, but I believe it's in the range of about 40% overall response rate and well tolerated. But it does not have similar toxicity to what BR has, and I think that's why it's an appropriate agent to add to a BR backbone or to a chemotherapy backbone.
Trying to think about, I guess we are using, in Hodgkin's, we're using chemotherapy with brentuximab. So I guess that would be one analogy. So are you planning to use bendamustine / polatuzumab vedotin?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think it's a good option for people who don't have CAR T transplant or clinical trial as an option. I don't think it's, you know, now the standard of care. I would say it is a standard option that should be available to people. I think it's palliative. The progression-free survival is in excess of 14 months. I think that's really nice to be able to see in a disease where otherwise patients don't really survive, you know, more than 6 or at most 12 months. So,
and of course, I guess you have people at different ends of the curve in terms
that's
of
correct.
Maybe even going beyond that. But for example, in a patient who had disease progression on CAR T or who wasn't going to be thinking about CAR T or transplant, where would this combination fit into your algorithm after relapse?
Yeah, so I think the post-CAR T progressions is almost a separate box today. That's one of the biggest unmet needs right now, particularly for younger patients who have gone through CAR T where it doesn't work. You know, nothing seems to work in that particular setting. I mean, chemo doesn't work in that setting. Other biologic agents don't really seem to work. So that's a huge separate bucket. But where I see something like polatuzumab BR fitting in is for, let's say, the older or frail patient who, you know, can't travel to one of the centers where the more aggressive options are available or doesn't want to, or has comorbidities such as a low ejection fraction or other comorbidities that would make the higher risk procedures more high risk.
So what are some of the other options you consider in that setting? We were talking about R-squared or lenalidomide. That certainly might be in consideration. Anything else that would sort of be in that first round for this sort of frailer patient?
Well, I mean, I think there are some drugs on the horizon that are coming out. There are some checkpoint inhibitors, like macrophage checkpoint inhibitors, that might have activity. There are other agents that are in study, I would say. I know that there are some BiTE antibodies that are under investigation. But right now, what the practicing oncologist would have at hand for somebody who has relapsed either after an auto transplant or can't get to an auto transplant and can't go to CAR T or can't go to allo transplant, for that patient, the options currently are R-squared, Pola-BR, palliative chemotherapy. You know, everything that is done in this situation is completely palliative.
Did you say macrophage checkpoint inhibitors?
Yes.
Macrophage. So, wow.
Yes, macrophage.
Okay.
So, yeah, there's a protein CD47 on the surface of different malignant cells that engages with SIRP alpha on macrophages. And there are now anti-CD47 monoclonal antibodies that seem to be very promising. There was a publication last year in the New England Journal based out of Stanford. I was part of that study as well, showing that rituximab plus this compound, it's 5F9-4U, is active and well-tolerated. So those studies are ongoing.
In what, lymphomas or?
In relapse and refractory lymphomas. There's also now studies in leukemias as well as in solid tumors, not with rituximab, but with other monoclonal antibodies.
Wow, interesting. So you mentioned the neurotoxicity. Of course, we have a lot of experience with brentuximab. Mm-hmm. And of course, now you have it's combined with chemotherapy, but is it your take that it's similar to brentuximab, not as difficult or qualitatively the same?
I think it's qualitatively about the same as what you'd expect with brentuximab vedotin. Maybe a little bit less, but it seems to be quite similar in terms of peripheral neuropathy.
So the other thing that's kind of cooking along, and you can tell me when you think we might see the results of this, because I interviewed Laurie Sen not too long ago, is the upfront study with polatuzumab. So I think that's what polatuzumab R-CHOP?
That's right. And it's very similar to some of the Echelon trials where they remove the vincristine because you now have a second neurotoxic agent.
Right.
So it's polatuzumab RCHP versus standard R-CHOP.
And where is that study? Have you put any patients on it?
Yeah, we don't have that study open. It is run out of Canada, or at least Laurie Sen is one of the main investigators on this, and it's open through a number of different sites around the United States. But I don't have it open.
Any feedback yet in terms of tolerability, in terms of neurotoxicity, or any other problems?
No, I mean, it's still quite early, I think, in that. I mean, the accrual's going well, but I have not heard any data on toxicity or stopping rules.
So I guess when you think about it, in a way, it is a little bit similar to Echelon 1.
Yeah, exactly.
Be interesting to see if you get kind of similar, maybe some advantage. This is internet. Well, you said Canada, so we'll see, because that was, we'll talk about that as relates to Echelon 1. So
and
just,
the other,
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say that, you know, polatuzumab, I mean, where does CD79B sit? It's part of the B-cell receptor. So I'm really curious as to how this study is going to turn out, especially because we have results like the Phoenix trial where, you know, BTK inhibitors also shut down B-cell receptor signaling. So we'll see, you know, what polatuzumab does in this area.
So I guess nobody's looking at rituximab, ibrutinib, lenalidomide, and polatuzumab yet.
Yeah,
but
that's right.
Who knows?
Add agent X, yes.
Yeah, we heard about, we'll talk about the non-chemo approach, you know, in CLL and FL, but I never thought it was ever come to diffuse large B-cell, but that sounds good to me. So let's just talk a little bit. We could spend the whole time here talking about diffuse large B-cell, which I think it's great because it, like, yeah. Seems like 2-3 years ago, it was like there was nothing to talk about, or, you know, CNS prophylaxis, whatever, traditional kind of stuff. Now is like, whoa, hold on. So let's talk about CAR-T, which, again, we could talk about for a long time, but just bottom line right now. And, of course, we talked about it a lot with Jeremy Abramson in the symposia. Maybe you can just talk a little bit about where we are right now in terms of CAR T, what we know about it. And in particular, one of the things that Jeremy was talking about that honestly I don't remember hearing before, again, through the eyes of what the oncologist sees, was beginning to see differentiation in the different products, which I never really heard about before myself. But now I'm kind of starting to hear that. So tell us about CAR T.
Yeah. So, I mean, there's three products that have been furthest along. They all are chimeric antigen receptor T cells engineered against CD19, but there's a difference in the activation domain, whether it's a 41BB or a CD28 activation domain. There are different compounds that are furthest along. The compound, which is one that is not FDA approved, is different from the other two in the sense that there is a separation of the CD4 positive and the CD8 positive T cells, and there is probably a more refined calculation of what dose of T cells a person is going to be receiving. And in terms of the biology, I think, you know, Jeremy probably is better versed to be able to explain that. But I think there may be a difference in terms of, you know, which cells are activated and what kind of efficacy you have.
He was also talking about, I guess, the time sequence of when you see cytokine release and the neurologic syndrome. What do we know right now in terms of efficacy?
I think in terms of efficacy, they're all, you know, from my perspective, they're all quite similar in that altogether about 40% of people can have long-term remission. So this is quite remarkable. I mean, 40% on the surface doesn't sound, you know, particularly exciting. You know, we want it to be 100%. But when you think about these patients, you know, these are the patients who have had frontline therapy, usually a salvage regimen, often an autologous stem cell transplant, and sometimes even another cycle or two of other agents to try to keep their disease at bay. And when they go to a CAR T, to have 40% of those patients enter a complete remission. And what seems really exciting is that if they're in a complete remission at 3 months, that this predicts for long-term remission with follow-up now getting close to several years on average for many of these trials.
So, I mean, actually 40% with those kind of results is actually spectacular. And one of the things I'm kind of curious about is I've seen some math calculations that suggest that not that many people are actually getting CAR T right now for diffuse large B cell. Is that correct? And if so, what's going on?
Yeah, no, I think that's, you've just hit on one of the biggest challenges. You know, we now have a therapy that can really offer substantial relief and remission to patients. And yet there's a number of barriers. You know, the first is purely access. You know, CAR T is only available at a number of centers around the country, and I expect that to increase over time. So perhaps that barrier will diminish over time. But right now it is limited to not a handful, but I would say, you know, maybe 50 different sites around the country, which for a big country is not very much. But the other piece is really patient selection and who should and should not be considered eligible for a CAR T. Sometimes patients come with too many comorbidities. Other times, you know, they are just too frail. There are different things that go into who gets selected for the CAR T process. And then the third issue is still cost. And right now, you know, certainly at our center, private payers, you know, you often have to negotiate and make sure that the price is understood and that it will be covered. Otherwise, it's a substantial cost to the institutions that are doing this. And then when it comes to Medicare and Medicaid, it can often be very difficult to get approval. So there's a delay that's built in as we try to obtain approval, and then we lose some patients along the way there too.
We've talked a lot, and you know, I think people can actually go to the video of the meeting and hear more about some of the discussions we had about tolerability and toxicity. But I'm just kind of curious how you sort of see this playing out over the next few years, if in fact people actually start having this therapy being made available to them. Let me ask you something. Have you given CAR T yourself?
Mm-hmm.
And
yes,
are you a transplanter? Do you do transplants?
I would say I am a previous transplanter. I stopped doing transplant about 2 years ago. You know, and it's actually a really important point, I think. In our institution, to be able to do transplant and CAR T, there's a lot of quality metrics that go into this. This is a high-risk procedure with potential neurotoxicity, cytokine release syndrome, you know, close collaboration with your intensive care unit physicians. And, you know, the amount of regulatory and just sort of oversight and quality and safety pieces that were there, you know, that's been turned over in our institution to the director of the transplant program. So I formerly did transplant quite a bit, but made a conscious decision not to do it in the last few years.
I'm just kind of trying to figure out how this is going to play out, you know, if it ends up being given to a lot of people. And I was talking to Krishna Komandori, who's at the University of Miami near us, and he's past president or president of the was the transplant, now it's cell therapy or whatever.
Right.
But we were talking about the needs for, you know, education and transplanters. And I assume that it's eventually, theoretically, it's going to be the, you know, community-based transplanters, which there are plenty of, are going to end up giving CAR-T. What do you see as the key challenges there in terms of, you know, kind of learning not only how to manage the toxicity, but all the other aspects of the treatment?
Yeah, no, I hope it rolls out very slowly to the community, mostly from a safety perspective. And there's a lot to learn. I mean, even within institutions, the difference between the trials and the real world, we learned a ton about when to give steroids, when to give tocilizumab. You know, in the beginning, we were told avoid steroids at all costs, avoid tocilizumab. Now it's given preemptively. And I think there was toxicity as we had that learning curve as a community. And I do think that there will come a time when CAR-T should be available to people at multiple different sites, even if they have a low volume. But I think that day is still a ways off because we're still learning about how to manage the toxicities. You really need a team. You need an ICU team. You need a strong transplant team. You need nurses and nurse practitioners and pharmacists that all understand, you know, what's happening physiologically.
So maybe you could say the good news is it's only for a short period of time, right?
That's true.
I mean, we have therapies that we have to deal with for a couple years sometimes that are not easy to give. But this is one shot and you're done, right?
Yeah. I mean, in general, it is one shot and you're done. But that one shot is pretty scary and intense when you see cytokine release and how quickly in some people it can come on, or even recognizing the delayed neurotoxicity, it can be very scary. So, you know, perhaps I'm being maybe more cautious, but I truly believe that there should be a little bit of a lag before it's available everywhere because I worry about safety.
What do you see in terms of the time sequence? And I don't know if there is a typical patient in terms of when you see cytokine release, when you see neurologic syndromes, and when you see tumor response.
I do think that there's differences in the timing to neurotoxicity and the timing to cytokine release syndrome between the different products. In terms of efficacy, I don't really see a huge difference, partly because the numbers are so small. And so I'm going to withhold judgment on that just for now. You know, certainly when you look out in the real world, and at ASH 2018, you know, we saw several presentations about CAR-T being used outside of clinical trials. And I think what was optimistic there is that people who would not have qualified for the trial, either based on performance status or some comorbidities, actually seemed to do, you know, similarly to people who were on the studies themselves. But the total number of patients reported is still on the smaller side. So in terms of comparative between the three products that are furthest along, I just think it's too early to say. The other piece is that there are competitors to the current three products. There are off-the-shelf CARs where you don't have to wait to generate it from a patient. There are others where the CAR product actually has two targets, epitopes that they target. And I think we're going to see a lot more about this in the future.
So I was interviewing Nupur Rajay, who was involved in the same seminar that you were, but she was doing the myeloma part of it. And we were talking about CAR-T. And, you know, there it kind of doesn't seem like it has the same arc, so to speak. You know, it is effective. It bumps people out a little bit. But it kind of doesn't sound like the same story, in, for example, in diffuse large B. So I want to ask you about mantle cell too later. And Nupur and I were talking about the fact that it kind of reflects the basic biology. You know, when you think about myeloma, you can't cure it. It's a long-term disease. Diffuse large B cell, you get a shot and sometimes you cure it. Does that make any sense in terms of kind of maybe what we're going to see moving forward?
Yeah. I mean, the story in multiple myeloma, I think, has been very eagerly awaited to see, you know, what kind of activity is going to be there. And we know that CAR-T is also being tested in solid tumors. And if it works there, I mean, that is a complete complete game changer for so many people. But the challenge is that with CAR T, I do think in diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, you know, in some ways we got lucky in that we have an appropriate target, CD19. We have a disease that is responsive to T-cell activation in a way that maybe multiple myeloma may not be. And as Dr. Rajay was saying, you know, this is a disease that you can get remissions and sometimes cures. Whereas, you know, for an indolent disease, or not indolent so much, but, you know, multiple myeloma, an incurable disease, the biology must be just completely different.
So we'll see where that heads. I want to move on, actually talk a little bit about mantle cell, but I keep flashing back to that triplet. I was just thinking ibrutinib, lenalidomide, and rituximab, immunologic effects.
Yeah.
Like, what would you expect the immune system is doing if you give those three drugs?
Right. So, you know, going back to the follicular lymphoma experience, because I was part of that, and that study really told us not to test this triplet further, at least in follicular, you know, there are immunologic effects. In fact, we saw in the paper that Chaitra Rajani published in Blood with ibrutinib, R-squared, and follicular lymphoma, we saw some hypotension, we saw rash, we saw fevers. You know, there was certainly something that smelled of an immune activation process, even if it wasn't completely explained or clarified. Why we don't see that in diffuse large B-cell lymphoma the same way, you know, with Dr. Weston's presentation, I don't know. But certainly there is an immune activation component to each of those drugs.
So let's talk about mantle cell lymphoma. And I guess one of the key things that came out in the meeting as we were discussing it really relates to the management of relapse disease and sequencing of therapy and use of BTK inhibitors. So let's just start right out with the whole issue of second-line therapy in mantle cell. And can you talk about the options that are out there, the trial data that supports it, and how you approach it clinically?
Yeah, so with relapsed mantle cell lymphoma, this is a tough situation. I mean, mantle cell lymphoma, as we all know, is incurable. I think some of the longest remission durations we get are with upfront transplant, but not everybody gets an upfront transplant. At the time of relapse, right now, I would say the standard of care is ibrutinib, and it's ibrutinib indefinitely, based on first the study that came out of MD Anderson, and then subsequent studies that confirmed, you know, a response rate of about 60 to 70%, and maybe about a 20% complete remission rate. But it's very effective at keeping the disease at bay for certainly a year, or sometimes even a couple years if you're on that tail end of the curve. The challenge to me is, one, should acalabrutinib or ibrutinib be the first line BTK inhibitor? And then what do you do when that stops working? So, you know, I've been using ibrutinib primarily. I will say that acalabrutinib looks to be just as good. I think the toxicity profile is quite favorable. There's a lot less bleeding in my experience, and I think the data support that. I think it's slightly better tolerated in terms of asthenia and myalgias, but it is a twice-a-day drug, so there's, you know, pros and cons of how those two drugs get used. The challenge is that once the BTK inhibitors stop working, you know, you really kind of run into trouble, and that's where venetoclax seems to have some significant activity and would be a good third-line agent, again, all really in a palliative setting. In terms of sort of long-term control, I think the hope is that CAR-T will have some activity. There's very limited data on CAR-T in mantle cell lymphoma right now, but it's something that I hope gets pursued and that we'll have a little bit more information about it. I think allotransplant is always an option for people who have significantly relapsed and refractory mantle cell, but, you know, given the median age of 70 or over 70, that's not always an option for patients.
So getting back to the choice of BTK inhibitor, it's interesting when we pose that question to the audience in terms of second-line therapy and a patient, for example, relapses on BR. When we presented just a 65-year-old patient who relapsed after BR and R maintenance and then relapsed 3 years later, 50% of the audience says ibrutinib, but then 20% says acalabrutinib. Then when we say, okay, the patient has a history of atrial fibrillation, now 39% of the audience says acalabrutinib, only 7% says ibrutinib, and now you start to see other choices, including lenalidomide and even venetoclax. And then finally, when we just present an 80-year-old patient with the same scenario, BR, and then later relapse, again, we see more ibrutinib, but still a significant number of people saying, almost as many people saying acalabrutinib. Can you talk a little bit about how you sort of shade your choice? Or I know you normally use ibrutinib. What about in the patient with atrial fibrillation?
Yeah, I mean, if somebody has well-controlled atrial fibrillation pre-existing, I guess I would prefer to use acalabrutinib just because there is, you know, less AFib, I guess, being, there's really no data on this, but I would just say that acalabrutinib would be my choice for somebody who has comorbidities or contraindications where ibrutinib might be more high risk. For many of my patients, it's, so there's two points here. One is that you want to try to pick one of those two BTK inhibitors at the time that treatment is needed. The other is that you frequently run into people who are intolerant to ibrutinib, either because they develop atrial fibrillation or they have, more commonly, I think, the asthenia and the hand cramps that make me switch over to acalabrutinib. I think if somebody presents with atrial fibrillation that's well controlled, I'd probably still prefer acalabrutinib because there's a slightly less bleeding risk, and many people who have AFib are, you know, of course, also on some type of anticoagulation.
I'm curious, I don't know if you've actually used acalabrutinib, what you've seen with it. One of the things that I've heard about is a headache. Have you seen that?
I have. Yeah, so the headache is kind of this insidious daily headache that can be severe. It's usually more of a low-grade kind of pain that responds to caffeine, interestingly. And with continued use, actually, I've seen it go away.
Yeah, that's what I've heard, that it's kind of temporary. Mm-hmm. Any other impressions in terms of sort of quality of life and tolerability, ibrutinib versus acalabrutinib? We'll get into this later, too, as it relates to CLL. What about issues like arthralgias, and how much of a problem is arthralgias?
Yeah, I actually think the arthralgias are a huge problem. Certainly in my CLL population, it's one of the most common reasons that I have to reduce the dose of the ibrutinib. And with acalabrutinib, I don't experience that nearly as often. So I think there is a difference in these sort of low-grade but still pesky types of toxicities that interfere with quality of life.
So let's move on now and talk about CLL. There's a lot happening. Anne Lacasse and Bruce Chesson were our faculty for that session. And one of the things that we began was just trying to sort out upfront therapy, which has gotten really complex in the last year. So maybe you can talk a little bit about, from your point of view, it really seemed like it started particularly at ASH, kind of where were you prior to ASH in terms of upfront therapy? What happened after ASH, and then did anything change at ASCO?
So ASH 2018 was a pivotal moment for CLL. You know, the previous paradigm had been that if somebody was young and fit and had an unmutated phenotype, we would think about FCR. For older patients or unfit patients, we would think about BR or ibrutinib monotherapy as frontline strategies, you know. And if somebody had 17P, you know, we would use an ibrutinib regimen. What changed at ASH was the head-to-head comparison in both older and younger patients between chemoimmunotherapy versus ibrutinib. So going first to the younger population, what Tate Chanafelt had shown was that FCR versus ibrutinib and rituximab in younger patients, so these are people with a median age of around 57, that ibrutinib rituximab had improved progression-free survival, improved toxicity profile, which you would expect, and also a suggestion of perhaps improved overall survival for all comers. And then the other thing that was interesting in that study is that the ibrutinib rituximab worked in both mutated and unmutated phenotypes, and I think really puts FCR into a very small box of patients where you might consider that. And that would only be after, in my opinion, a lot of discussion about the risks and benefits of FCR.
Before you go on there, because when we talked about that with Anne and Bruce, so first of all, I thought that when they broke it out, actually, I mean, I don't know if it was valid statistically, but they couldn't show an advantage for ibrutinib for the mutated patients.
Yeah, it worked in both mutated and unmutated patients, but FCR still had an advantage, at least in the mutated phenotype.
Because, you know, again, we asked the audience, and the most common answer when we said the patient's 60, mutated, del17p53 negative, of course, most common answer was still FCR, and Anne Lacasse said she's still using FCR. So I guess not everybody's buying into that. I guess the allure has always been for that particular subset, the hope that you could treat and then be done. But of course, that may be happening with novel agents soon, too.
Right. I think what this study did for me, I mean, I still consider FCR for that particular patient, the younger patient with the mutated phenotype who understands the risks and benefits. What this study did was basically say that FCR is not the only option, you know, even for that patient, and that ibrutinib rituximab, even though it's indefinite and it's got its own potential long-term side effects, has this advantage, you know, for the overall population. And the thing about FCR is that it's a problematic regimen. I don't know that people really need all six cycles, for example. Maybe they only need four. I still have patients who are on IVIG 2 and 3 years later that it affects their quality of life. So I still think FCR has a role, but it's a much more complicated discussion and a longer discussion in my mind right now. And it really has to be the young, motivated patient who wants a limited duration therapy and is willing to accept the potential short-term and long-term risks.
Yeah, I've heard other investigators bring out the thought that maybe you shouldn't like push that hard to get the six cycles in if they're really having problems. You said you've seen people 2 or 3 years later getting IVIG.
Yeah.
But what about 10 years, 15 years later? Or do you have patients like that?
I do have patients that are 10 years out and, you know, close to 15 years out now. They do eventually, I think, get better. But I mean, I guess in my mind right now, I'm still thinking of, you know, a man who's in his late 40s who is 3-4 years out still needing it. Probably by 10 years, I hope he's okay, but certainly have quite a few patients that did need IVIG in the first few years.
What about the approach to the older patient who's not going to be eligible to FCR, but also, you know, as they get older, 75, 80, you know, we had this approach of using obinutuzumab chlorambucil, which was specifically targeted. That sort of captured some people's, you know, interest or imagination. They started using it. But we saw some more data that came out at ASCO that maybe also touches on the older patient. Maybe you can talk about that.
Yeah. So, you know, going back, first of all, to ASH, where in the older population, you know, this was Jennifer Woyak's study that essentially, in the intergroup study, that compared ibrutinib rituximab versus bendamustine rituximab for the older patient. And both of the ibrutinib-containing arms were significantly superior compared to bendamustine in terms of progression-free survival. And I think really, again, very similar to our FCR discussion, makes us sit down with the patient and say, what are you getting with BR? The advantages to BR are really just that it's limited duration, but when you look and see how much superior the ibrutinib-containing arms were, you know, I think BR is really for a smaller subset of patients. It's not your automatic go-to for your older patient with CLL, in my opinion, anymore. The other question that came up there was, is there a difference between ibrutinib versus ibrutinib rituximab? And, you know, certainly there were no differences in the curves, and it suggests that ibrutinib alone is sufficient for the older patient. But the problem there is that the ibrutinib is indefinite. And we've been talking about some of the chronic low-level toxicities that affect quality of life in patients. So wouldn't it be nice to have some type of limited duration therapy for the older patient? And that's where ASCO 2019 comes in, and we have the CLL14 trial. So what the CLL14 trial did was it took sort of our old standby, chlorambucil obinutuzumab, which had been previously shown to be better than chlorambucil rituximab or chlorambucil alone. So we have chlorambucil obinutuzumab as our standard arm in the CLL14 trial, and it is compared against venetoclax and obinutuzumab. And, you know, of course, chlorambucil is kind of easy to beat up on, so, you know, you could argue that. But there was a significant improvement with venetoclax and obinutuzumab over the chlorambucil arm, and this is a limited duration therapy. So there's 6 months of therapy followed by an additional 6-month extension, but overall, this is a limited duration therapy that was very well tolerated, was incredibly active. There were a number of complete remissions. And, you know, I think this is definitely going to be a challenge to the indefinite ibrutinib.
So before I ask you what you're actually doing in your practice, just to sort of round it out, in terms of this concept of limited duration novel therapy, one of the things you see in a lot of these trials is evaluation of MRD assessment.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about how that's factoring in and whether you think it has a role now or in the immediate future?
Yeah, I think in CLL, MRD status is going to have an important role in determining how long people need therapy and whether or not a particular therapy can be stopped. So we know that with ibrutinib, for example, Overall response rates are high, but complete response rates are on the order of about 20%. With MRD, it's even lower than that. Whereas for venetoclax, you can get somewhere between 40 and 50% MRD negativity. With the obinutuzumab plus venetoclax, it's even higher than that and probably closer to like 60% MRD negativity. So that gives you more confidence that you can stop the treatment and not worry so much about an immediate or a high-risk relapse.
Can you talk a little bit about some of the other therapies that have been looked at for limited duration, and particularly ibrutinib venetoclax?
Yeah, so there's also the ILLUMINATE trial, which looks at ibrutinib and rituximab. And there's also an ibrutinib and venetoclax study that's ongoing as well. So right now, you asked what I do for my patients. And, you know, again, these conversations have become much longer and I think more exciting, but I have the discussion for the non-17p deleted, non-p53 mutated patients. I have the discussion between, it used to be limited duration BR, which I guess still has to be there for the older patient just as a point of conversation, but I don't do that as much. Ibrutinib, which is indefinite. I was talking about obinutuzumab and chlorambucil as a limited duration therapy, and now that's going to be replaced by venetoclax obinutuzumab. So those are the three options that I present to patients. And I think the venetoclax obinutuzumab will become my go-to. I mean, this just got, you know, presented 2 weeks ago, so I haven't had a chance to really have that discussion, but I would lean towards using that at this point. Now, the one downside, and I know others have probably raised this, is that many people have thought about venetoclax as a good salvage, that if ibrutinib stops working, they can go to venetoclax. Whereas if you use it up front, then what do you do? You know, can ibrutinib salvage a venetoclax failure or not? And we don't have that data that's out there. I think that's a theoretical concern. I would just say I would like to use the best treatment available that is going to be well-tolerated, cost-effective, and limited duration. Those are some of the things that I value for my patients.
I wonder how the issue of TLS is going to play out with the venetoclax-obinutuzumab combination. You still start them both together, and you're still going to follow the package insert guidelines?
Yeah, I think the ramp-up is very well written out in the guidelines. It's going to be important for people to figure out who is high risk versus low risk for tumor lysis syndrome, because there will be a small number of patients that need to be admitted, you know, when they start this treatment, that you can't do the outpatient ramp up. But that being said, as long as oncologists are aware that there is this risk of tumor lysis syndrome, which I think people are, and that some people might need to be hospitalized, I don't really see that as a major barrier to adoption, especially when, you know, I currently have patients, for example, who are 2, 3, 4 years out on their ibrutinib, and they start to ask, okay, now when can I stop? Can I reduce the dose? You know, you start to run into that. Whereas the limited duration therapy, I think, is also better pharmacoeconomically. Of course, I don't know how all these things are going to get priced out, but there may be an advantage there.
So one of the things I wonder about in terms of, you know, how aggressive to be about TLS prevention, because the package insert, I think, is very clear in terms of white count and lymph nodes, et cetera. I don't know that it's that clear how you factor in renal dysfunction. And I'm curious how you factor it in. A lot of these patients are older. They have, you know, compromised renal function. Do you have sort of guidelines about what will trigger you to sort of move a patient up in risk status for TLS?
Yeah. I mean, it's not a strict cutoff, but if somebody does have renal insufficiency where, you know, first of all, allopurinol is not well tolerated, you have to reduce the dose, right, for TLS prophylaxis. And if I think I'm going to need something like respiracase, I will admit them. You know, I guess a rough rule would be if their GFR is less than, you know, less than 50, I'm going to pay attention. Less than 30, I'm definitely going to think about having them admitted to the hospital if they have a risk for tumor lysis syndrome.
And in terms of the venetoclax-obinutuzumab combination, let's say in a patient who's high risk, and you're going to have to put them in the hospital, how long would somebody typically stay in the hospital then?
I would say about 3 days, 2 to 3 days, usually not more than that. I think that once people have had the initial exposure, the ramp-up really, I think, does protect them against tumor lysis syndrome, at least in terms of like a massive TLS.
And 3 days, even if they're getting venetoclax alone?
Yeah, you know, well, I guess, so for us, once they start to get up to the higher dose, you know, like the second dose level or something like that, I think the TLS risk is mitigated, and especially once they get the obinutuzumab, I think it is much less. And we have the ability to do labs very often, and I'm sure most people do. So even if they do go home and you're following it, a lot of this is chemical, you know, TLS and not necessarily clinical. And there are things that you can manage with aggressive fluids, especially if they got respiracase in the hospital. So I don't have an algorithm for how long people are in the hospital, but I would say on average, I hope just a few days. I think if we're starting to have to admit people for a week or two at a time, then that's sort of a downside to the particular regimen. And I think it will limit its use.
Actually, to me, 3 days sounds long compared to other investigators. I hear more like a day or two, but what about the idea of like debulking somebody with obinutuzumab before you start the venetoclax?
Yeah, that has also been looked at, but obinutuzumab also has its own infusion reaction, you know, that is related to tumor bulk and circulating lymphocytes. So, you know, steroids, I think, are a good way to try to debulk somebody or at least prevent or mitigate the TLS risk a little bit. You can use a prephase of steroids.
I was just sort of flashing, you were talking about the patient who's on ibrutinib for a long time and wanting to come off. Do you see maybe in the future using MRD to try to help make that decision?
Yeah, and I do think that's being looked at right now. Is there a time when ibrutinib can be stopped because MRD negativity has been reached? The problem is that ibrutinib by itself, you know, the MRD negativity rate is modest, and sometimes it can take a very long period of time before you get there.
Might be interesting to see what it is when you give venetoclax obinutuzumab. I assume it would be a lot higher. The trial, it was a lot higher. And
yes.
Again, you wonder whether or not people might want to consider it. What about quality control and MRD assays? How are they done? Do they all kind of give the same results? Or what do we know about that?
Yeah, so right now, MRD in CLL is multicolor flow. And you can either use a 4-color or an 8-color. I would say most of the trials use an 8-color flow. And try to get to something like 10 to the minus, you know, 6th is very, very deep remission. I've seen other people say 10 to the minus 4th is sufficient, that's also a very deep remission. So I don't know that there is a single cutoff that is best for clinical practice, but certainly in the trials are looking at different values to see which one would predict for when you can stop something and what is the risk of relapse.
We were talking about acalabrutinib before as it relates to mantle cell. What about in CLL? What are the data that are out there? We talked a little bit about the toxicity profile, but what do we know about acalabrutinib in CLL?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in CLL, acalabrutinib, you know, very similar, at least in terms of safety and efficacy, it seems to mirror what we see with ibrutinib. I don't see anything distinguishing between the two in terms of efficacy. When it comes to tolerability, again, I do think acalabrutinib has a slightly more favorable toxicity profile with less arthralgias and less of this sort of asthenia that you can see, maybe less bleeding and a little bit less of atrial fibrillation. So, you know, again, the main downside to acalabrutinib is that it's a twice-a-day drug and some people will balk at that, but it otherwise seems to be much better tolerated. There's studies combining acalabrutinib with obinutuzumab, which I think are very interesting. There's this, I think, you know, maybe theoretical, maybe real interaction between ibrutinib and rituximab, where you remember ibrutinib hits several different kinases, including ITK. And some have proposed that this ITK inhibition antagonizes how rituximab and ibrutinib work together. Acalabrutinib does not hit ITK and therefore may be a better drug to combine with something like obinutuzumab, which is glycoengineered, and there may be some synergy there. Now, I don't know if this is theoretical versus real, but certainly acalabrutinib and obinutuzumab were presented at ASCO this year in combination in a small study and seem to be very, very active.
Of course, both of those drugs are active, but
yeah.
I'm guessing there's some kind of phase 3 trial looking at that combination.
That's correct, right? There will be a phase 3 trial, you know, essentially paralleling what like the CLL14 trial was.
So is that up and running or not yet?
I don't know just yet.
Interesting. Yeah. Let's talk about relapse disease in terms of second and third line therapy. Can you talk a little bit about how you think that question through, let's say in a patient who's an older patient?
Yeah, I mean, so right now, most of my patients who have progression are progressing on ibrutinib. And so I would switch to venetoclax right now. And I think that's an appropriate option. I mean, we still have lenalidomide too, which I've used less and less in this setting, but it is still out there and still an appropriate option for some patients. But I've been using venetoclax as my second line therapy. Now, once we start adopting the CLL14 study, where venetoclax is used up front with obinutuzumab, I'm not really sure what I would use second line, but it would likely depend on the durability of response from their frontline therapy. So somebody who's had a very long remission after upfront venetoclax obinutuzumab could either get ibrutinib second line or venetoclax again. I would think about that. There's no data just yet, but I'm just sharing how I would think through that patient. Whereas if they have really primary refractory or an early relapse, that might be somebody you'd want to move more quickly to something like a CAR-T.
What's kind of beyond that for you, and particularly where do PI3 kinase inhibitors fit in?
Yeah, so PI3 kinase inhibitors in CLL, I think, have a lot of competition. You know, between the ibrutinib and the venetoclax, by the time somebody is considered for a PI3 kinase inhibitor, they're going to have very, very difficult to control disease. I mean, there are PI3 kinase inhibitors that are available. Idelalisib is out there. There are several others on the horizon, including umbralisib. And I think it would be third line, but it would be quite palliative. My hope is that they can be tested in combination, which might make them a little bit more effective.
So let's finish out talking about follicular lymphoma. And of course, one key question we want to ask 1 year later after the big R-squared upfront trial was presented last year at ASCO is what people are doing upfront. You could maybe guess when we present a 60-year-old younger patient who needed treatment, how Ann LaCosse and Bruce Chesson voted on that one. But obviously now we have the issue of R-squared out there. And most of the audience, though, is still sticking with R-bendamustine as upfront therapy, a much smaller fraction, including Bruce, thinks about R-squared. And you see more people thinking about it as the patient gets older and more frail. Can you talk a little bit about where you are today in terms of upfront therapy?
Yeah, so upfront therapy for follicular lymphoma, as you just mentioned, the RELEVANCE trial was presented at ASCO 2018, so a year ago, and it was a phase 3 randomized trial of R-squared versus BR in treatment-naive follicular lymphoma that needed therapy, so patients who were meeting the GELF criteria. And it was designed as a superiority study, but what we found is that there was essentially no difference in outcome between the two, that R-squared and BR had very similar efficacy, different toxicity profiles, and different length of treatment. So the R-squared in that study was actually given for 18 months, whereas BR, as we all know, is only 6 months. So in my mind, what the RELEVANCE trial did was give one other option for upfront therapy in follicular lymphoma without a clear and confident way of saying which one was better, worse, or the same. I think they're just different. And so I think it's very reasonable to continue to use BR upfront for patients who want 6 months of therapy and are okay with getting some type of chemo. I think what changed at ASCO this year is where I personally think lenalidomide is going to have a much bigger role, which is in the relapsed and the refractory setting. So we had, you know, two trials, the MAGNIFY and the AUGMENT study, with some information that came out. And both trials are testing R-squared in relapsed indolent lymphomas, but there are some differences. The MAGNIFY trial was, it starts out as sort of a single-arm study where everybody gets R-squared for relapsed or refractory follicular lymphoma and marginal zone. And then there's a randomization between continued R-squared or continued R alone, okay? And in that particular setting, certainly there is a response rate of about 80% and a CR rate that is, you know, around 30 to 40% and well tolerated. The AUGMENT trial looks at just rituximab sensitive patients. And here patients get randomized to either R squared or to R monotherapy. And there's a significant advantage. In fact, you know, 39 or 40 months for the R squared arm for PFS versus only 14 months for R alone. And to me, the AUGMENT trial was very helpful because for many of us, we use rituximab monotherapy in the relapse setting. And up until now, there hasn't been large-scale data showing us what you get with R monotherapy. And this shows 14 months PFS, and that's not really all that great for a disease like follicular lymphoma. And in contrast, the R-squared arm, you know, has this 40-month PFS and, again, is well-tolerated. So to me, both of those studies suggest that certainly in the relapse setting, lenalidomide and rituximab have an important role.
You know, it's interesting because, I mean, you could almost view it a little bit as a continuum to first-line therapy, at least in my mind, you could view it that way, because there's been a lot of debate about the tolerability of, quote, R-squared. And, you know, in the trial, they actually were treated for 2.5 years. It was a very long maintenance phase. You know, Bruce Cheston says, oh, I give it for a year and then I'm done. So, you know, now you're talking about kind of other variations of anti-CD20 with lenalidomide in terms of, I guess, minimizing the tolerability. If you do use R-squared up front, do you use it exactly as it was done in the trial? And what do you find in terms of how people tolerate it?
Yeah. So the reason Bruce was saying that is because there is a CLGB, now Alliance trial, that looked at just 12 months of R-squared. And I was part of that study as well. And you know, I don't know why 18 months was picked for the relevance trial. Certainly for people who were part of the Alliance trial where you stopped at 12 months, that seems to be sufficient. So, you know, without really having large scale data, I agree with Bruce. I don't think you necessarily need more than a year of R squared. I don't even know if you need a full year of R squared, but we have no data for less than a year.
So I don't know how often you run into a situation where you have to decide upon third-line therapy, but I assume it's pretty common.
Yeah.
And I'm curious how you think it through, and particularly, again, thinking about the general medical oncologist now having 3 PI3 kinase inhibitors to choose from. Where does PI3 kinase inhibition fit into your algorithm, and which one?
Yeah. So it is, I think, third-line therapy. That would be where I see PI3 kinase inhibitors fitting in. The 3 that are out there, idelalisib, duvelisib, and copanlisib, and probably soon we will have umbralisib, you know, in the next year or two would be my guess, and there are many other PI3 kinase inhibitors that are in development. The challenges with idelalisib, which I still think is a very active drug, is that, you know, there are some things to watch for, including hepatitis and colitis. But that being said, I think idelalisib is an active and effective drug, especially in the relapse setting. It seems to be a little bit better tolerated than when it was used up front, which is when we saw a lot more of the toxicity. So idelalisib is an appropriate option. If you try to choose between that versus the newer ones that are available, duvelisib and copanlisib, you know, the main difference is that copanlisib is IV, that it also hits PI3 kinase alpha. And so you end up with this really unusual hypertension and hyperglycemia that is transient and then goes away, but you know, you have to continue with an IV administration. So for some people, they may prefer that. They may want IV over pills. And for some patients where co-pays are an issue or taking pills in general is an issue compliance-wise, that would be appropriate. And I would pick it more on those patient factors rather than on sort of a comparative efficacy evaluation. Duvelisib, I think, is quite promising. It does have both delta and gamma inhibition. Infection is one of the complications that was seen with duvelisib, but it seems to be otherwise well tolerated. And I think it has some advantages over idelalisib in terms of not having to watch for the liver toxicity and the colitis.
So I want to ask you a couple of questions about Hodgkin lymphoma. We also talked about that, just a couple of issues. One is upfront therapy. You may recall we presented a case to the audience of a young man with high-risk disease. And actually, in contrast to the way people usually answer the question of what's your first-line therapy, when we presented a high-risk patient, the majority of the audience and both of you and the faculty said bevacizumab/AVD. Can you talk a little bit about where we are today with that upfront decision?
Yeah. So Echelon 1 was a randomized phase 3 trial of BV-AVD versus a BVD. And this was a trial that I think changed things for me personally, certainly for high-risk patients, the ability to avoid bleomycin, and 2, to avoid the need for the PET scan after 2 cycles to make treatment decisions, you know, was a nice advantage. And I have started using BV-AVD in my patients with high-risk Hodgkin lymphoma.
How do you see the trade-off for the standard risk patient?
Yeah, for the standard risk patient, that's a harder thing. I mean, they didn't, you know, the study was an all-comer study, and there was a 4% improvement in PFS, modified PFS, for all patients who were entered on the study with advanced stage Hodgkin's. If you look at the North American cohort or the younger cohort or the higher risk cohort, that 4% differential increases for each one of those subsets. So, you know, I'll acknowledge these were not pre-planned or powered to look for differences specifically in those subsets, but it's hard to ignore some of the differences and the improvement in progression-free survival coupled with the ability to avoid bleomycin. So for the standard risk patient, I think there are two good options. One is BV-AVD. The other one is to use the RAFL approach, which is to give ABVD for 2 cycles, and then use the interim PET to determine whether or not you can safely eliminate the bleomycin. I think it's a discussion. Many patients want a novel agent in the front line. Many people do not want bleomycin. So I think over time, even moderate risk patients will get BV-AVD if it's available to them.
In terms of, quote, moderate risk patients, would you still say to them that they will have a slightly decreased risk of relapse? In other words, is this sort of a relative risk reduction that goes down the spectrum?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's quite close, but it was statistically significant. The PFS difference was statistically significant for everyone who was enrolled in the study. So I feel comfortable saying that. Now, there was no difference in overall survival, and we now know that BV in the salvage setting is, you know, very active, and I don't know how using BV up front would affect the ability to use BV in the relapse setting, but it's definitely a conversation. And some people may say they don't want it because of the risk of neuropathy, and there we use the RAFL approach. So I don't think it's really a one-size-fits-all. I do think for my highest-risk patients, I've started using BV-AVD quite routinely. For the moderate-risk patients, it's a discussion of whether or not they would prefer the RAFL approach or not.
Another issue we touched on in the symposium was the issue of bridging therapy to transplant. And we asked the audience how they approach it. Most said ICE, as well as Jeremy. But we've seen more and more people answer bevacizumab and nivolumab because there are some data out there that are very interesting. I noticed that you gave that answer. How do you think through this issue?
Yeah, so the BV nivolumab is still in phase 2. And actually, there was an update, I believe, at Lugano this week. But what was really interesting is that there is a very high CR rate with BV plus nivolumab, and that after transplant, the progression-free survival was very similar to people who had gotten chemoimmunotherapy as their salvage regimen. So I may have answered that maybe more on the provocative side because I have not personally, you know, used BV-NEVO as my first-line salvage, but I do think the ability to avoid chemotherapy in the salvage setting and still get patients to transplant where it works is really exciting.
What about the older, non-transplant eligible patient with disease relapse? What's your usual first therapy?
Yeah, it has been BV monotherapy. And the reason it's been that is, for one thing, it's straightforward. It's one dose every 3 weeks for up to 16 weeks. And the second is that we now have 5-year data showing that if somebody goes into a complete remission with BV, that at least a portion of those have very, very durable remission. Maybe a third of patients at 5 years still haven't relapsed. And I think that's really exciting that a single agent can do that. Now, with combination data emerging, BV plus NEVO, you know, is what I would like to do. I'll be honest and say I've tried to do that in 2 people and have been turned down by insurance. It's not FDA approved just yet, but I do hope that at some point in the future that would be an option available to people.